Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few weeks, Monterey Bay, which is about 100 miles south of San Francisco, has been transformed into a spectacular gathering of marine mammals. If you go whale watching out of Moss Landing, you are almost guaranteed to be surrounded by breaching whales, dolphins, jellyfish, birds, and sea otters. The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, which was established in 1992, is one of the four largest marine sanctuaries in the U.S. It spans across an area of 4,600 square nautical miles. The sanctuary was established for resource protection, education, research, and public use. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what explains all of this incredible activity and what are the best ways to protect our waters and marine life. Today, we're joined by Paul Michel, superintendent of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, and he joins us on the line from Santa Cruz. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Jim Harvey. He's director of Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. His work focuses on the ecology of turtles, birds, and mammals. And Jim joins us on the line from Moss Landing. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Doris Welch is a marine biologist and co-owner of Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watching in Moss Landing. Hi, Doris. Thank you for joining us. Hello, Doris. All right, we'll connect with Doris in just a couple minutes. So, Paul, why don't we start off with you? I've gone whale watching a couple of times over the last 2 months and have just been completely overwhelmed. I mean, within 3 minutes of leaving the harbor, we saw so many whales, we couldn't even catch up with or keep up with them. And then hundreds of dolphins. The naturalists that I've talked to say that they've never seen anything like this. What explains all of this activity?
Well, it is fantastic. We often refer to the Monterey Bay as the Serengeti of the sea, just for all the amazing wildlife that's there, and it's been there. And I think what's happened in the last couple of years is that we're just seeing all this wildlife closer to shore. And maybe Jim can talk about maybe why that is, but we're thinking that the prey species, the forage fish that the whales and dolphins are feeding on, are just closer to shore. So that just puts them closer to us to enjoy them.
Yeah, in fact, Jim, the last time I was on a boat, we couldn't go back to shore because we were surrounded by so many whales. And finally, when we were able to go back, we saw a whale so close to shore and a ton of anchovies. I mean, the water was almost black because there were so many anchovies in that area.
Yep, that's exactly right. And Paul Michel's correct that one of the reasons why I think this year in particular everybody's been so excited about the amount of wildlife that they can see, especially the humpback whales, is the anchovies are are really close to shore and in great numbers. So it really provides an amazing visual impact for people that are going out.
And so how much of this has to do with warmer waters and global warming? Why are we seeing so many anchovies in that area, Jim?
Well, I guess the answer to that is we really don't know. It's pretty obvious that there's large numbers of schools of anchovies in the bay right now, which has attracted all the wildlife. It's hard to tell exactly why we are having that. We had the same sort of situation occur last year where we had huge numbers of humpback whales near shore with another large group of anchovies. So it's happened 2 years in a row, and it may be somewhat related to the warm water blob that we've talked about and other conditions that are sort of unique right now.
And Doris, are you back with us?
Yes, I just got connected. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. That is Doris Welch. She's a marine biologist and co-owner of Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watching in Moss Landing. Doris, you are lucky enough to be out on the bay every single day. In fact, you've been out on the bay every day for the past 6 years. What really strikes you about what you are seeing today versus, say, 5 years ago?
Well, it really is an incredible difference in that we have very consistent, abundant humpback whales feeding very close to Moss Landing on a daily basis. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay, great. So what we saw even 3 years ago, we'd have to go for a longer distance to find whales, and there would be much fewer whales, and we'd have to search more. Now, we literally come right out of the Moss Landing Harbor, and we're seeing whales blow right from the harbor mouth. We've had consistently humpback whales feeding here for the last year and a half straight now. Last winter was the first year that we had humpback whales, a core group, small group of them, say 15, stayed all winter rather than migrating south to the breeding ground.
Wow. Well, we were just talking about anchovies because the last time I was on the water, I mean, you're seeing so many anchovies that that part of the water is almost black. And so what do you think explains all of this activity right now?
Well, I always say it's all about the anchovies. I can't really explain why we have such an influx and abundance of anchovies, and the recruitment keeps happening, so we have them year-round near shore here. But I can tell you what I see, and that's a lot of animals, not just the humpback whales, but invasions of birds like the elegant terns feeding on them, abundant pelicans, and certainly seals, sea lions mainly, and lots of long-beak common dolphins that have been very common here in 2015. So it's a true feeding frenzy, and it's concentrated in certain areas of the bay, mostly in front of Moss Landing and certain spotty areas pretty near shore.
And so, Paul, we don't know if this is a trend, but we can say that over the last 3 years or so, it's been getting better and better, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the sanctuary is actually in really good shape, and we just published, or in the, almost ready to publish, an update to our condition report. It looks at the condition of the entire sanctuary from near shore to offshore to estuarine waters. And what the report really summarizes is that it's the sanctuary is in really good shape. And I think that's due to, you know, this 23 years of focused management and protection here, water quality improvements and sewage treatment and ag practices and stormwater management. And fisheries management, you know, there's no overfishing that occurs here anymore. And the regulatory, you know, programs of the Sanctuary and Coastal Commission and others, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, that, you know, really taking a focused approach to the management and protection of this area. And there's no better place in the world to study it, too. There's 25, you know, institutions that do ocean research here as well.
And so talk a little bit, first off, about what it means to be designated a marine sanctuary. Why is that so important?
Well, it does a couple of things. It, like I said earlier, it brings a focused attention to an area, and it is more like a national forest than a national park, in that there's all these multiple uses that occur here, but with this resource protection umbrella over it. And so it brings together the best and brightest in marine science and education and outreach and policy and programs to do really an ecosystem-based, comprehensive management to the area. And I think with all the attention brought to it, you know, there's just a growing awareness by the public and their interest then in becoming stewards and just taking care of the land and water that they live in.
And, Jim, what would you add to that? Why is a marine sanctuary designation so important?
Well, for one reason, the main one, of course, off California, is that it eliminates the possibility of oil exploration being occurring off here. And as Paul Michel said, that there's a lot of other things that go on for monitoring to water quality, to helping maintain the water quality in the sanctuary. But I guess I would also add that there's been a lot of emphasis recently on that there's been a dramatic change in the quality of the Monterey Bay. And I guess I would take a little bit of different view of that. I think the bay's been exceptional and very productive for long periods of time, and it really hasn't. The productivity hasn't changed very much as far as human-related activities. It's mostly just changes in environmental conditions. And one of the big ones that occurs that we may be going through a change right now is there's something called the PDO or Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and it's about a 15 to 25 year period of time where the water conditions are changed depending upon a variety of environmental changes. And we're just went through a cold water phase, which is usually a very productive phase for the west coast of North America. So it's very possible that we may see a change relatively soon here back into a warm water phase, which is less productive. So we should take advantage right now of getting out there and seeing the wildlife as it is right now, because it may be changing.
So what would cause this to change?
Well, we really don't know, actually. It's something that's it's been noticed for the last over 100 years that there's this change that occurs, and we really don't know the mechanism by which it drives those kind of changes. So We just know that there's a pattern. We just right now don't really know exactly what's causing the pattern.
Well, so how let's elaborate on this a bit. What, Doris, what would you add to that? Because at a time when so much of the news about the planet is pretty dire, it was just amazing to be in Moss Landing and see so much activity and so much life. And so a lot of people say that in 1992, the Monterey Bay wasn't doing so well. It was depleted of marine mammal populations and fish populations, but now, because of the designation, it is doing well. So what would you say? How has that changed what you're seeing out there?
Well, I certainly think that the sanctuary has improved water quality, and one of the main things is that we are not allowing oil drilling and exploration, and that is very important to protect the otters, that one single oil spill could wipe out our entire otter population. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, from what I see, is that there's a lot of public awareness and stewardship, and that is why we have like more eyes out on the bay. When anything is amiss, when anybody sees any behaviors that should be reported, it's being reported to the sanctuary, NOAA, and being taken care of. But let me tell you, I have been out on the bay for 35 years now, fairly actively, and we used to do marine mammal surveys way back when for UCSC, who I worked for. And we were not seeing any humpbacks back then. So I'm seeing, and also we're seeing an increase in the otter populations, the pelicans, the peregrines, you name it. But it's because of protection and also active conservation restoration efforts to increase these populations and bring them back. The fundamental problem was over-harvesting, overtaking of both fish mm-hmm. and of marine mammals. And now that they've been protected, and we're talking about a long stream of protection here, starting in 1972 with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, before that for the sea otters, and then with the International Whaling Commission moratorium on whaling, we've got many decades of protection. Many of these are long-lived species. We're now seeing a comeback in their populations. Now, I also agree with Jim that we've got long-term issues like the PDO, and what I've seen out on the bay is we had this amazing krill blooms that were happening 5 years ago, bringing in lots of big baleen whales like the blues and the fins. In the last 3 years, we've seen this shift to an increasing anchovy population, and they are fed upon by the humpback whales and other species that we're seeing today. And it's so striking because it's so close to shore and just a truth-feeding frenzy. So there's a lot of different variables. Sanctuary is important, but also the fact that we've stopped over-harvesting.
And that is Doris Welch. She's a marine biologist and co-owner of Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watching in Moss Landing. Paul Michel is superintendent of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And Jim Harvey is director of Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. His work focuses on the ecology of turtles, birds, and mammals. Today, we are talking about the health of the Monterey Bay and what it takes to create a healthy ecosystem. If you've been out on the bay, I'm sure you've been blown away by all of the activity that you've seen. So many whales breaching, you don't even know where to look. There's a ton of dolphins, hundreds of dolphins, jellyfish. If you're lucky, you'll see some orcas, birds, and sea otters. If you've been out on the water recently, we'd love to hear from you. What have you seen? And then also, if you're a scientist, a conservationist, if you care about these issues or work in this industry, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about what explains all of this activity? And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Paul, what would you add to that? How can you help us understand what's happening here? Because we've got a lot of amazing protections. There's so much more public awareness now. It seems like there's so much good work being done between scientists, conservationists, and people who care about these issues. I mean, they're on the same page. But then you have rising ocean temperatures. So how can you make sense of what we're dealing with right now?
Well, we're all trying to kind of make sense of it. I think it's basically a response to, you know, the more you look, the more you find. I mean, the more we explore the ocean, the more we discover. And I think similarly, with the more people that are out on the water and looking out towards the water, the more they're seeing. And I think, you know, this rebounding ecosystem is just part of the story. The other story is that people are drawn to that, and the more people, you know, that visit and see, the story just goes like wildfire. And before you know it, you know, everyone wants to be out there and see the wildlife. And that's great news. It's great news for the wildlife and for the recreation and tourism sector. But it also creates a bit of a problem for us that are responsible for the well-being of the wildlife. And we're seeing and we're hearing a lot of reports of people, you know, getting way too close to these marine animals and endangering themselves as well as the animals. And so part of it, I think the message just needs to be, you know, go and enjoy, but be very respectful of the wildlife and don't get in trouble. You know, that we can love them to death, and we don't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to take a selfie with a whale, because the last time we were out there, we saw a boat practically run over a whale. It was a smaller boat. It wasn't an ocean, you know, a whale watching company, and it almost ran over the whale. And then the kayakers were also so close. A couple weeks ago, a whale breached onto a kayak. Luckily, the people didn't die, but they were thrown out of their kayak. And so now I understand, is this true, Doris, that the local kayaking companies are now telling people you cannot go out because there's so much whale activity?
Well, that is not quite true. We're sending out, we tried to send out an education message about being careful and not approaching the whales too closely in your kayak. We got the video from our boat. I observed that incident, and it was terrifying to see a whale literally breach on top of a kayak, and I'm so glad the people were okay. They were driven under the water and then popped up. They had life vests on. I wouldn't say they were being careless. They were with a group, and that tour company has opted to not take whale-watching trips out of Mars Landing anymore. I think if somebody is very knowledgeable and very sensitive to the whale's behavior, they can probably kayak around the whales safely. However, large groups of kayaks of inexperienced people is probably a recipe for another disaster. So I think we need to be very careful with public awareness and education. That's the most important thing we can do. Now, the small boats, the small motor boats that are privately owned, maybe fishing boats and recreational boats, I've seen a lot of them that seem to not know at all about how to act around whales. I think we need more public awareness and education for them as well. I can speak for the fleet of whale-watching boats, but across the board, most of them know how to act around whales and are very cautious and respectful of the whale's behavior, not to approach too closely and not to do anything that would alter their natural behavior. However, it's the general public coming out in their individual watercraft that really we need more education for.
And Jim, what would you add to that? The BBC did a special from Moss Landing and got incredible footage, which of course raised awareness. And a lot of the whale watching companies just cannot keep up with demand.
Yeah, that's true. And it obviously the big attraction was the humpbacks, but as Doris and Paul Michelle said, there's lots of other activity that's going on in the bay, all attracted to the bay because of the amazing resources of food that are available to them. And Paul Michelle sort of used the Serengeti of the sea kind of image, which is very true, that most of these animals that we're watching are animals that are reproducing elsewhere and then migrating to Monterey Bay to forage. And so conservation-wise, we can continue to manage the local resources and the bay as best we can, but we also have to be mindful that a lot of the species are coming from elsewhere, and if they're being harmed or disadvantaged in their breeding locations, there's lots of possibilities that those species could be impacted. For instance, a good example is one that I study with Scott Benson, one of my colleagues from the National Marine Fisheries Service, where we've been studying leatherback turtles. And the leatherback turtles who come to our bay to feed on jellyfish are coming across the Pacific from the eastern Pacific, and they are harvested there. The eggs are harvested on the eastern Pacific, and So that population, even though the jellyfish populations are doing reasonably well here, are impacted by things that occur elsewhere. So we also have to be mindful that a lot of these species can be impacted by foreign kind of problems, and hence why international law like Doris mentioned, with the International Whaling Commission and National Marine Fisheries Service, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, all are things directed at trying to sort of deal with these issues in a global sense.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
And guests, I am excited hearing about everything that's happening in Monterey Bay. It's so good to have some good news happening in our environment. My question is, how can other bays, particularly in California and the San Francisco Bay, emulate what's happening in Monterey Bay so that we might be able to have some good news up here as well?
All right. Thank you, John. Jim, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Yeah. I think San Francisco Bay is doing very much the same sort of things. There's a lot of new programs going on to increase water quality in San Francisco Bay and protect different species. And the bay is actually responding very dramatically. We're seeing huge numbers of harbor porpoise, for instance, that have come back into the bay that weren't there before. A lot of the different species, fish species, that are coming back. There's still a lot of problems in the bay, and one of the biggest ones with San Francisco Bay is that it has a huge number of invasive species. In fact, I've been doing work on harbor seals in that bay, and the number one food item for harbor seals in San Francisco Bay is a yellowfin goby, which is a invasive species from China. So that would indicate that there's still lots of problems in San Francisco Bay, but they're doing very similar things that has happened off Monterey Bay, in the sense that there's a whole group of people, scientists, conservation groups, regulatory agencies, that are all working together to improve the water quality there, and I think it's getting much, much better.
And what is that species from China?
It's a yellowfin goby.
And how did it get here?
Most of the invasive species come in the ballast water of ships. So ships are moving across the ocean with all these goods, and when they get here, they dump their ballast water, the water in their holds, and in the ballast water is all these different organisms that have been transported from the home port, and they are dumped here in our bay and then take up residence. And, for instance, like I said, the yellowfin goby has taken up and become a really dominant species in the system, so much so that harbor seals use it as one of their primary food sources.
Wow. And, Paul, what would you add? What advice would you give to people in other areas, and are you seeing similar policies being enacted?
Yeah, I think it boils down to just, good governance and public awareness and stewardship. And so I think, having a focused designation, whether that's a sanctuary or a national estuary program or National Estuarine Research Reserve, some sort of designation and organizational tool to bring, the policies and programs and science and education to an area is really the defining thing. And right now, actually, across the country, the National Marine Sanctuary Program is asking coastal communities all around the country, and Great Lakes and all the coastal communities, to nominate their special place for consideration of new National Marine Sanctuary. So this is a very exciting time for the National Marine Sanctuary Program. And actually, here locally, we are kicking off management plan review. That might sound very exciting, but we have a big management plan that really directs what we should work on, and we're asking the public for their feedback on that. So we're having scoping meetings up and down the coast and getting feedback on our current management plan and what we should be focusing on. And just interestingly enough, we had our first scoping meeting last week in Monterey, and the number one issue that the public raised was this issue of wildlife disturbance. And I think that's just highlighted by, the BBC, PBS production here and all the folks that are getting out on the water and enjoying the wildlife.
Right. And when we come back after break talking about disturbances, a number of environmental groups, Earth Justice, Greenpeace, and other groups, are celebrating because they say whales are going to gain long-sought protections as the Navy limits sonar use. So we'll talk about that after the break. Today we are talking about all of the amazing activity that we are seeing in the Monterey Bay. Now is a really amazing time to be out on the water. You're guaranteed to be surrounded by whales. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective you've not yet heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. Toll free, You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Dee Watkins. He's out with a new book, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. He believes that newspapers should print daily death counts of women and black women and men who are killed with photos and casualties like they do during wartime, because he says for black America, this is war. So how should we combat this national crisis? On Wednesday, we'll have a discussion about the horrible fires that are taking place in Lake County, and we'll talk about the role that global warming is playing in lengthening these fires. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the Monterey Bay and what it takes to create a healthy ecosystem. If you have a chance, you've got to go to Moss Landing and go out on a boat, because you are almost guaranteed to be surrounded by whales, dolphins, jellyfish, birds, and sea otters. If you're lucky, you'll see a few orcas. Today we're joined by Doris Welch. She's a marine biologist and co-owner of Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watching in Moss Landing. Jim Harvey is director of Moss Landing Marine Laboratories, and Paul Michel is superintendent of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And since we were talking just about disturbances, I wanted to ask you about this recent sonar announcement by the Navy. Earth Justice and Greenpeace have filed so many lawsuits over the years, and finally the Navy has said it's going to limit its sonar use. How significant is this, Paul?
Well, I think it's significant in that it's a recognition that sound in the sea has impacts. And while we don't fully understand all of that, we know that it is detrimental. One of the things that we're doing, working with the science community here, is trying to get a handle on what is the soundscape, if you will, of the Monterey Bay and the sanctuary. So we're putting more listening devices out there to get a background of, you know, what is the, you know, the background noise in the sanctuary, so we can start to get a better handle on what potential impacts there might be. But I think it's just a growing recognition that sound is different in the ocean, and the animals that live in the ocean hear things very differently and are affected by sound in a much different way than we are. So trying to understand that is very difficult, but this is good news.
Right. And even the Navy's own estimates show that this sound could kill 155 whales and dolphins off Hawaii and Southern California. And so this applies to Hawaii and California. Anything to add on that, Jim, the significance of this?
No, I agree completely with what Paul Michel said there. Yes, sound is really important for a large number of species, especially the adonocetes, the toothed whales. They use sound to navigate, to vocalize, to interact with each other, communicate, and so it's a huge issue for them. The baleen whales, the humpback whales that we've been talking about, and others use it to communicate also, and so it's a huge issue, and I'm glad that the Navy has finally stepped forward and agreed that there are issues with it and that they're going to try to mitigate those.
All right. Well, thanks again for the call. Let's hear from Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Thank you, Jim, Doris, and Paul. My feeling is that after the Fukushima, I have a couple of reasons here, after the Fukushima nuclear disaster, there's tons and tons of highly radioactive water that are constantly entering the ocean because they have to keep the meltdown areas underwater. They can't. So this water goes into the ocean, and it'll create a death zone around the plant and around the West Coast. And secondly, the plant pumps 2.5 billion gallons of water a day to cool the reactor. And in that process, they kill billions. In fact, over 30 years, they've most probably killed multiple trillions of fish, larvae, and the animals get caught up against the gratings because of the suction there, the tremendous suction. It really is detrimental to marine life in every which way. And one Fukushima day, and it's all over for the West Coast. So I call for the closing of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant to enhance California's coastal marine life.
All right, thank you. Doris, do you want to take that one on radioactivity?
I actually would like to add to the acoustics, because I had something to say about that one. I'm not an expert on the radioactivity.
Okay.
But I would like to say that we've been doing hydrophone recordings out there on the bay, and it opens up your whole world to seeing these marine mammals and the birds and the fish in a completely different realm. They're much more relying on sound for getting around in their watery world than sight. And when you hear, the humpback whales are actively making feeding calls and amazing vocalizations right here in Monterey Bay. And so when you're putting a lot of sound out into the sea, especially when it's high intensity sonar and such, it can definitely interfere with their behaviors, and their communications are probably more important auditorily than visually. As far as the radioactive piece, I think it is something that we definitely have to be aware of and take note. If a disaster like that happened here on our coast, we would have a whole different ocean out there, and it would not be a good thing.
Paul or Jim, anything to add on radioactivity?
Yes, well, I know that on the we have a program with marine scientists here called Kelp Watch, and we've been taking regular samples of kelp, because if the Fukushima radiation was to show up here on the West Coast, it would show up first probably in bioaccumulation in the algae. The biggest marine algae we have is kelp, and so we've been testing that kelp, and we found signs of Fukushima radiation. There's actually probably more of impact from marine debris from the tsunami that's affected the West Coast than there is of the radiation from Fukushima.
All right, and was that Paul or Jim? I'm sorry.
It was Paul.
Okay,
sorry.
Paul. And Jim, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. One of our professors is actually working on that kelp watch and helping collect samples on that. And yes, the answer is that there's very little, if any, radiation that's being detected with them. Then we also have a professor here at Moss Landing Marine Labs, John Geller, who's been working on the invertebrates that have been transported across the ocean on debris from the Fukushima disaster. And those invertebrates, again, have a signal that associated with the disaster, but not huge amounts. So the radiation is really at very small amounts. But I do agree with the caller that on the West Coast or the Western Pacific, the problem that's been there is going to consistently go on for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Harvey and Berkeley. And let's go next to Anita in Santa Cruz. Hi, Anita. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've had similar experience to Rose out of Moss Landing on a couple whale-watching trips. But what I wanted to talk about is an experience yesterday at Mitchell's Cove in Santa Cruz. There was a single humpback whale coming extremely close to shore. There's been some news reports about it. It's been happening for about a week. But yesterday, the disturbing part was the sheer number of people that were wading out into the water trying to get as close as possible to this whale. And one man put himself directly in the pathway of the whale so that he could reach out and touch it. I've got photos of it, too, and he did, in fact, try to grab its fin on the back as it was passing. And what happened after that was he came back to shore bragging about it and up on the walkway bragging about it. He got counseled by a whole lot of concerned people that, you know, you're not supposed to be doing that. But all the people in the water then waded directly in the pathway trying to have the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, as a witness, when you see this kind of behavior, what do you do? When, you know, is there anyone who might want these photos? That's my question.
Yes. Well, thank you. Doris, can you answer that?
Absolutely. And what you can do is call NOAA and the sanctuary. And they have, not only do they have enforcement people that are out there to enforce the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and clearly this man was in violation of it by approaching the whale, trying to touch the whale, and must have been altering the whale's behavior. But then also the sanctuary has a wonderful crew of volunteers, the Baywatch volunteers, and they're out there and certainly could have had staff or volunteers come out and do some public education. What a wonderful opportunity that would be. So now that we're aware of that issue, I think that's something that with Paul's help, we can attend to, and a great opportunity for public education and also taking care of our whales.
Right. And that's illegal. We have an,
it is illegal.
Right.
Yeah.
We have an email from Serena who says, yesterday there were people who were getting way too close to the nesting seals at the beach near Half Moon Bay. The signage is inadequate, and the cones warning people not to go past a certain point were very small and easily missed. I saw so many people heading straight for the seals and saw that some of the seals were appearing to be trying to go away from the people. Education is really important, and shows like this can really help.
Absolutely. I've worked with education. I've been the education advisor for the sanctuary for many years and also worked at Long Marine Lab and the Oakland Museum. And the more we can get people out there educating folks, shows like this, but people on the ground educating folks, docents, it really helps. But the public, as stewards, you have an opportunity to communicate with us and let us know what's happening so that we can provide that level of stewardship out there and education in the form of docents, volunteers, and staff.
And, Paul, it seems like this is a no-brainer, but a lot of people don't know that they're not supposed to touch wildlife. I mean, I've been on snorkeling trips where people are trying to pet turtles.
The education awareness is key, because most often people just don't know that it's not, you shouldn't do that, right, and know why. It's really only the egregious things like what was talked about earlier about the person just, you know, trying to get on top of the whale and pet it. That's obviously an infraction. But, you know, we have, like Doris said, we have Team Ocean volunteers that are out in kayaks, mainly here in Monterey off Cannery Row. We also have Baynet volunteers that are there to educate people along the bike path and some in Santa Cruz as well. But we all need to do a better job of being out there. The enforcement is overwhelmed by this, just the sheer number of people that are doing things they shouldn't be and the few number of enforcement officers that are available to us at the state and federal levels. You know, but if you see something that doesn't look right, please call the NOAA hotline at 1-800-853-1964, 1-800-853-1964, or call here at the sanctuary office, 831-647-4251, and we'll try to get a response and or at least to start documenting as much of this as we can.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call and the email. And let's go next to Susanna. Hi, Susanna. Welcome to the show. Do we have Susanna? I wanted to ask you about overfishing, Jim, because you brought that up earlier. And a pretty dire report just came out from the World Wildlife Fund recently showing that about a nearly 50% decline in marine life populations happened in the last 50 years. So, actually 40 years, sorry. A 50% decline in marine life populations between 1970 and 2012. Did you hear about that, and what are your thoughts?
Yes, no, I did hear about it, and yes, it's alarming, and fortunately for us in the United States, we have very good laws. The National Marine Fisheries Service is responsible for the federal response in regulations associated with fishing outside of the state waters, and then the states all along our coastlines are responsible for their state waters, and most places, it's gotten much, much better as far as trying to reduce overfishing and maintain the populations at a level that's sustainable over a long period of time. And quite a few areas around the United States, you'll see that the populations are rebounding. A good example right now is rockfishes, which were overfished dramatically, and at least 10 to 12 different species who had been fished to below their 2% below their original biomass. And all of those species, almost all of them, are all returning back and are actually now being at a level that they're allowing fishing to take place on them. So there's some very good things that are going on in the United States to protect our fishing. But the rest of the world is obviously needs protein, and one of the ways to do that, of course, is to go out in the oceans and fish. And they don't have as strict of regulations as we do, so there's an alarming amount of fish being taken and other marine products being taken around the world that is not sustainable. And we're going to pay for it in the long term if we don't get a handle on it.
Right. Well, I think we're already paying for it right now in many places because, I mean, you, for example, this report also found that the tropical reefs have decreased by half and could be lost by the year 2050.
Yep, it's all true. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of concern with a large number of obviously one of the big reasons for this is population growth. And although it hasn't been in the news very much recently, it's certainly in the past when everybody became alarmed about how fast our population was growing in the world, it hasn't subsided at all. And so the increased numbers of people on this earth are just putting a lot of pressure on the system and are going to continue so as long as we keep trying to get as much food as we possibly can from the oceans. Mm.
Jim Harvey is director of Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. Paul Michel is superintendent of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And Doris Welch is a marine biologist and co-owner of Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watching in Moss Landing. Today, we are talking about what it takes to create a healthy marine ecosystem. And we're talking about all of the amazing activity that is happening in the Monterey Bay. I keep repeating myself, but I can't say it enough. If you can, go whale watching out of Moss Landing because you are guaranteed to see so much incredible activity. And you can also join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you're a conservationist, if you care about these issues, if you're a marine biologist, what explains all of this activity that we're seeing, and what can we do to emulate this in other parts of California? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Kate in Alameda. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much. I am a parent of a six-year-old, and we watched all of Big Blue Lies. She's totally obsessed with the Monterey Bay. And I'm just wondering if you could give any recommendations for whale-watching trips that are particularly family-friendly and would be especially good for children.
Okay. And I'm sorry, how old are the children?
Six.
Six. Okay. Doris, what about that, whale watching with young children?
Okay. Great question. We do encourage families with young children to come out with their kids. I think six years old is the perfect age to get them out on the water. I'm going to give you my recommendations for the younger kids. Bring them out on the morning time, shorter trip, 8 to 10 a.m. when it's going to be calmer. We'll have the whole time watching whales for them. Also, get them on a smaller boat, like the sanctuary boat that I run, because then they'll have some one-on-one time with the marine biologist and who's also an educator and teacher. And what a great thing that you want to get your young kids out on the bay to experience this firsthand. That's how we're going to create future stewards of our environment. I know that made a difference for me as a child. All my ocean and beach and sailing time fostered a love for the marine world, and now I'm doing that every day with adults and kids. But yeah, the main thing is for school-age kids, get them out on the bay. Morning trips are generally calmer out on the bay than the afternoons, although October we have really good late afternoons. Now, also the other thing is that I know the Big Blue Life, people saw that, and they all it made it sound like this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience here. Actually, what we're seeing is over the last 3 years, more and more humpback whales feeding, and they're extending their feeding season through the fall into late fall. So there's plenty of opportunity and time, most likely, for people to get out on the bay this fall.
All right. So would you say six is the minimum for children?
I recommend six and over.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that phone call. Let's go next to Kathy in San Francisco. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I think it's a mistake to encourage people to go out on boats and in the water. I think people should stay on land and use binoculars. And also, the people that work on the ICBM missiles for warfare, for killing, they've invented machines that can turn trash into fuel for cars. So it could stop all this drilling offshore and fracking. We have a technology. It's just pure greed. And also all the jobs that are being lost to computers and robots, we need to figure out how to get jobs for all these mostly men that are in the slaughter of whales, dolphins, all the fish, for pet food and all that. In vitro meat from Netherlands have done it. One of the Google guys was funding it. And it should be front page news every day on updates on in vitro meat turning. So we could put all the slaughterhouses out of business. We need jobs for all the men that are working in these slaughterhouses around the world. And I'm a vegan, but I think maybe alligator meat as a transitional meat to have everyone stop eating all animals except alligators.
All right. Well, let me get a comment from our guests about your first comment about the boats being bad for wildlife. Jim, you've spent years dedicating your life to these issues. What are your thoughts about boats going out on the ocean and then the way that humans interact with wildlife?
I guess my answer would be if too much of anything can be bad, and certainly if there's too many boats and they're and the operators are acting irresponsibly, then there's going to be issues. But I, at least all the work that I've done, there can be some interactions with animals that are negative. But if the boats are acting responsibly, the people with, that are operating them are doing it the right way, I don't think there's that much of an impact. It's it can be a disturbance when there's a lot of boats in one spot and their whales don't have very much ability to get away from them. But most of the boats, especially in Monterey Bay, are very cognizant of the fact that they need to operate properly and do so. So I don't think it's a big issue, at least in our area.
And what do you think, Paul?
I would agree with Jim that anything too much of anything is going to be a negative impact. But you know, for the most part, at least the operators, the commercial operators that we see do so in a responsible way. It's mostly the private boat owners and kayakers and others that when the whales are really close to shore, that's when we have issues.
All right.
But I like the generation of ideas. I want to put a plug in for our remaining scoping meetings to weigh in on what the sanctuary should be working on. Our next one is in Santa Cruz this week at 6 o'clock at the Loudon Nelson Center. We have one coming up in Half Moon Bay October 14th at Half Moon Bay Yacht Club at 6 o'clock. And our last one's in Cambria October 23rd at 6 o'clock at the Veterans Memorial Hall. So come with all your great ideas.
Great. And where can we find information about these meetings? Is there a website?
Yeah, just go to our main website, montereybay.noaa.gov.
Okay. Perfect. And we've got that at yourcallradio.org. We have a question about sardines from Philip. He writes, we've been hearing about large numbers of sea lions and seal pups being abandoned by their moms due to the lack of food this year. And yet now there seems to be an abundance of anchovies on the local waters. What gives? I'm so glad you wrote this because I remember the Chronicle had this fascinating story in April called Sardine Population Collapses, Prompting Ban on Commercial Fishing. I'd love to get your take on this. So a number of the marine biologists in the article blame this on the fact that regulators set sardine fishing limits too high. And to bring this to, you know, globalization, what's happening is that the sardines are being fished out of California's waters. They're being frozen in these big blocks of ice. And then they're being sent to Australia and Japan to feed to bluefin tuna who are in, they're in fish farms. So it's just so fascinating to think about this web of the food system that's so globalized now. Doris, what are your thoughts on that? We've got a lack of sardines, but an overabundance of anchovies.
Yes, well, historically, the research shows that we have these 50-year swings. So every 25 years, you get more anchovies, every 25 years, more sardines. So it's rather a natural occurrence that's been documented for years now. Good studies have been done by Scripps and also Imbari. So that being said, yes, there's been a collapse of sardines, and yes, the young sea lion pups have come starving and early weaned up to Northern California. So we have seen starving sea lion pups, them dying off. But there's so many anchovies up here. We've also seen a great deal of feeding up here. So some of them, the fitter ones, are surviving. So the concern about our fisheries being moved, overfished, then moved off to different countries is a really important one.
Right.
And I think that does warrant some global attention. I know that our fisheries are highly regulated here. I feel a level of confidence that between the state and National Marine Fisheries Service, federal, that they're overseeing quite well. However, when dear to my heart are all the wildlife out here that are feeding on the anchovies, and I personally want to make sure that we sustain this fisheries, not only for human populations, but also for our wildlife. So it has to be monitored very carefully.
Right. And Jim, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, it is interesting to think about that sardines are mostly sold for bait, so overfished and then sent overseas to feed to bluefin tuna farms.
There's it's a lot of controversy about that. And as Doris said, the part of the reason why we get these changes from an anchovy kind of dominated system to a sardine dominated system is the one I mentioned before, this idea of the Pacific decadal oscillations, which change water conditions. When it's colder off the coast of California and the off the west coast of North America, we get anchovies. When it's warmer, we typically get sardines. And so the National Marine Fisheries Service and the state have been very good about trying to regulate fishing to not to overfish the sardines. So there's this natural change, but at the same time, fisheries management is not a perfect science. And so there are issues of sometimes trying to make sure that you regulate how many fish are being taken so you don't overfish them. But with the global economy the way it is and the amount of price that they get for fish offshore, the fishermen, of course, are going to send the products where they can send them with get the best price. So there is an issue of moving fish around the world and therefore taxing the system at the local level if the fishing is good here and the price is better elsewhere. And we hope at some point that we can do a better job of marketing the fish here so that the fish stay in the local markets, feed the people locally, and you have less of a carbon footprint in sending those fish across the oceans.
And Paul, as you're starting to put these meetings together to get public input about, you know, what's next for these sanctuaries, why don't you leave us with your final thoughts?
All right. Well, you know, we just can't take for granted that, you know, things are in great shape and they will be forever. And so, you know, part of our due diligence is to make sure that we are addressing the priority issues. And we can't always understand everything all the time. So getting the public's input is really, really important in this process. And so I would just say, you know, get involved. You know, whether you want to be a volunteer for Team Ocean or Baynet or one of our water quality volunteers, or you want to come to a public scoping meeting and let us hear your thoughts, or come to one of our advisory council meetings and get involved. It takes involvement and it takes awareness and stewardship, and we're all in this together.
Paul Michel is superintendent of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Jim Harvey is director of Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. And Doris Welch is marine biologist and co-owner of Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watching out of Moss Landing. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What's it like to be a black man living in the United States? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Dee Watkins, author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Watkins believes as innocent black men and women are killed on a regular basis, newspapers should print daily death counts with photos and casualties like they do during wartime, because he says for black America, this is war. So how should we combat this national crisis? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.